VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From finding a newborn exoplanet to signs of the oldest oxygen in the universe, an electric wind on Venus that may have stripped away its oceans, to newfound clues about mysterious dark matter, astronomers have made some remarkable discoveries recently. Today, we'll talk with some of the scientists behind those discoveries. My first guest is Andrew Mann, an astronomer and a Hubble Fellow at the Department of Astronomy of the University of Texas at Austin. Dr. Mann led a team of astronomers that discovered the youngest fully formed exoplanet that has ever been detected so far. This new planet lies around 470 light-years away in the constellation of Scorpio and is called K2-33b. Dr. Mann, you and your colleagues have discovered what just might be the youngest fully formed exoplanet that has ever been discovered. Just how young is it?
This particular planet is approximately 11 million years old. A rough estimate on the age, it could be as young as 5 million years old.
Now, how far away is the planet?
So the system's about 150 parsecs away. That's a little over 300 light years.
What do you know about this planet so far?
Well, we know its size. It's a bit bigger than Neptune, about 5 Earth radii. We know its orbit. Our year is 365 days. Its year is only 5.5 days. So it's orbiting very close to its star. We can sort of make guesses about its mass and its composition, but we don't really know those yet, although we hope to figure those out soon. Although we do know sort of a lot at this point, there's still a lot to be learned about its atmosphere and other components like that.
Discovery is said to be of a fully formed planet. Does this mean that all the steps that are involved with its formation are complete?
A lot of previous discoveries have been sort of signatures of planets. What you look into a disk, the gas and dust material that forms planets, and you see sort of indications like there's a hole in the disk where a planet is forming or something like that. And so that's not a fully formed planet. This one is slightly older than those systems, and so its formation is probably complete. Now, it still may evolve a little over time. It may shrink a little. It may lose some atmosphere through interaction with its star, but it's done with the basic formation process. Its inside is not changing. It's not accreting new material in any significant fashion.
Speaking of accretion, I understand that planets such as Earth form from the gas and dust left over from the creation of its star, and the material does accumulate into something called an accretion disk. Are there still remnants of an accretion disk around the planet's star?
So there are. There's the remnants we see, we call it a debris disk because there doesn't appear to be any gas left. It looks like it's just sort of like rock-sized material, and it's further out from the planet. It's at something like 2 AU, is twice the distance from the Earth to the Sun. We call that an AU. So it's about much further out from where the planet is, but we can detect that through observations far beyond where your eye can see, far into the infrared. This material is bright. And so, yeah, we do see a debris disk there, which tells us something about how recently the planet formed and that planet formation is done at least this close to the star, but it may be still ongoing further out.
I've been reading that the planet is being referred to as a super Neptune. Why a super Neptune? Just because of the size?
Yeah, just because of the size. So we like to use these benchmarks of the solar system. So, you know, objects that are sort of things that are very large, we call them Jupiter-sized, and things that are roughly Neptune, we call those super Neptunes. There's sort of these in-between objects that some people call super Earths and some people call mini Neptunes, and it's based almost entirely on either the size of the object or the mass of the object, depending on how it was detected. In our case, we don't actually know the mass for certain, so we go with the size, and it's a little bigger than Neptune, so we call it a super Neptune.
How does this planet compare to the other 3,000-some exoplanets that have been discovered so far?
So it's unusually large, considering its, you know, stars come in a range of sizes and masses, and this particular star is much less massive than our sun, and less massive stars tend to produce smaller and less massive planets, and so it's quite big compared to other similar stars. The planet is big for its hosts, we say, but in some sense, in the big picture, it's not an outlier, which is good. It looks a lot like a lot of other planets we found, which is encouraging because we want to learn about how those other planets around older stars form. If this were a weird planet, it would be sort of very bad, actually. Like, be hard to infer things about the older population. So what really makes it unique is actually just its age, how young it is, not its size or mass or any other components.
Andrew, compared to planets in our own solar system, just how close is this planet to its host star?
It's much closer than anything we have in our own system. So the Earth is, we say it's 1 AU from its star, it's defined that way. And this one is 0.05, so 5/100ths the distance from Earth to the Sun. So it's much closer in than Mercury on a much tighter orbit, which is also what makes it interesting. These planets don't look anything like what we have in our solar system because of how close in they are.
I know there's been some theories regarding our own solar system that planets such as Jupiter have moved in and out of orbit closer and further from the Sun. Do you see this planet doing the same thing?
Yeah, so this is one of the things that makes it really interesting. So not to go too far afield, but when people first started looking for planets around other stars, they found a number of these sort of close-in giant planets, and it's hard to explain how they got there. We don't have any large close-in planets around our own Sun, and sort of basic models of how planet formation works suggest that they cannot form there. There isn't enough gas and dust and material. And there's lots of different hypotheses for how they get there. One is through interactions with the disk, basically like it's dampened, it's going through a fluid. Another is interactions with a nearby star, so a star sort of pushes it in slowly. But the nice thing about this planet is because it got close in so young, we can rule out a lot of those hypotheses because the process has to happen very quickly for it to get in just 11 million years, the age of the system. So we can rule out things like a more distant star pushing it inwards because that takes hundreds of millions of years or billions of years and just hasn't had time to happen. So we think that's what happened in this case, something closer to interactions with the disk pushed it inward.
Andrew Mann, thank you so much for sharing your insight and for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you.
That was Andrew Mann, an astronomer and a Hubble Fellow at the Department of Astronomy at the University of Texas at Austin. Joining us now is Elwin Wooten, program scientist with the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array Radio Telescope in Chile. He is also an astronomer at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Charlottesville, Virginia. Astronomers who use the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array Radio Telescope recently discovered signs of the oldest oxygen ever found in the universe. The oxygen was determined to be formed no later than about 700 million years after the Big Bang, the explosive beginning of our universe. Atoms of oxygen weren't possible until long after stars had formed and collapsed. Al, you and your colleagues have detected the presence of oxygen in deep, deep space. Where was it detected?
At a redshift of 7.3, which means distance, it's about 13.8 billion years ago.
What would be the significance of finding this grouping of oxygen in such a distant time?
Well, we don't know when stars first formed in the universe, really, but it was somewhere at a redshift of 7 on back to 10 or 11 or so, we think. And the first stars that formed, we also think, were massive stars that processed the hydrogen and helium in them on through the heavier elements very quickly. When you add sort of 4 helium nuclei together, you get oxygen. And so that's one of the first elements that's formed other than hydrogen, helium, lithium, and beryllium that are formed in the Big Bang. So this oxygen would then be some of the first oxygen formed in the first stars in the universe. And oxygen is now, of course, the most abundant element in the universe after hydrogen and helium.
The oxygen that was detected so far away, was it pure O2 or was it in some other form?
No, it's neutral oxygen. And it's neutral oxygen that's missing 2 of its electrons. So we call neutral oxygen O1 because it has all of its electrons, and it's oxygen 3. Roman numeral 3, meaning it's lost 2 of its electrons. So in order to lose its electrons, it has to be in a region with a lot of energy, such as you might have where a lot of stars were just forming. So it's ionized oxygen.
As you had mentioned, only elements present right after the Big Bang included hydrogen, helium, and lithium. How were other elements, such as oxygen, then formed?
Well, they were formed in those first stars. We think the first stars were very massive. In order to put enough matter together to make a star, you have to be able to cool the matter. And hydrogen and helium are not very good at cooling matter. So we think there were huge accumulations of matter, which were then able to cool through hydrogen and helium radiation and make very large stars. Those very large stars, like the massive stars we see around us now, went through their evolution very quickly. And so in the nuclear reactions in the centers of those stars, one was combining hydrogens into helium and then heliums into carbon and oxygen and so on up through iron. And when you get to iron, you have a supernova, which then spreads all those elements into the interstellar medium. So the oxygen we see presumably went through that process and was distributed into the interstellar medium by a supernova in one of those first generations of stars.
Quite curious about the formation of early stars. Since the amount of elements accessible at that time was kind of limited, how did these early stars form?
Well, to some extent, that's a mystery. I mean, we've never actually seen these early stars. And in order to get the matter together, you have to be able to cool it. And it's difficult to cool matter with hydrogen and helium because being very light elements, the spectral lines, the radiation that they emit comes only in discrete packets, of course, and that comes at pretty high energy packets. And so it's hard to cool things down to low levels when all you've got is hydrogen and helium. Other elements, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and so on, have lots of spectral lines. And so in the universe around us, when stars are formed, they cool through emissions from all those other elements, basically. But that's the problem with the first stars, is it's difficult to do that. And so we think you had to get a huge amount of mass together and make supermassive stars. Sometimes they're called population 3 stars. They were just bigger than the ones that we have around us now. Such stars burn their nuclear material very quickly and explode and spread it into the interstellar medium.
I understand that one of the aspects of this finding is that it's going to provide some insight into a period of the universe's history called cosmic reionization. Can you tell us about that?
Okay, well, everything formed in the Big Bang and was ionized and all came back together. And so then it became neutral. We had lots of neutral hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium in the universe. And then that began to congregate, eventually cooled and make stars. At that point, those stars emitted a lot of radiation and started ionizing the hydrogen and helium again. And probably that's what's happening in this oxygen 3. It's been ionized during an episode of reionization by starlight from those massive stars.
So is the study of this area where the oxygen was found continuing?
Oh, sure. In fact, the authors applied for some director's discretionary time on ALMA for follow-up studies.
What are they hoping to find?
I'll just tell you what I would do next. What I would do next is look for the oxygen 3 at a higher resolution. You can move the ALMA telescopes around on the ground from a very compact configuration in which they're all within 150 meters of each other. And that gives you sort of a lack of precision in your measurement of what the object looks like on the sky. It's sort of like you see a fuzzy blob. But then you can move the antennas out as far as 16 kilometers out and increase the precision. As you do that, the brightness of the object gets less and less, so there's a limit to what you can do. So the first thing I would do would be use an array of the telescopes, which was slightly larger, to see if I could pinpoint the emission a little better and be able to measure the frequencies. And so some frequencies are a little bit more redshifted, some are a little bit less redshifted, and that suggests rotation of the gas. And by looking at the rotation, you can see whether this object is like a normal galaxy or whether it's just a big blob with no particular redshifted areas or blue-shifted areas, as it would be if there were just a large explosion.
That was Ellen Wooten, program scientist with the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array Radio Telescope in Chile. He is also an astronomer at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Charlottesville, Virginia. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. I'm your host, Rick Pantaleo. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA, or send us an old-fashioned email to pcusa@voanews.com. We'll be back with more of our program after this.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
We're back with the science edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. We now talk with Mark Kamienkowski, theoretical physicist and a professor with the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. Professor Kamienkowski was part of a study that suggests the black hole binaries, which generated recently detected gravitational waves, just might be a signature of the mysterious dark matter which makes up most of the mass of the universe. Professor Kamienkowski, could you explain what dark matter is?
I wish I could explain what dark matter is. The problem is that we don't really know what it is. We do know that most of the matter in the universe is dark. It does not shine like ordinary matter shines, like stars shine. It's not composed of the same stuff that we're made of, protons and neutrons and electrons in ordinary atomic matter. It's something completely different. We have no idea what it is. It outweighs the ordinary atomic matter by about a factor of five. And it's a big mystery. We've known about its existence since the 1930s and even more so since the 70s. And over the past two decades, it's become absolutely clear that there's a lot of it, and we know exactly how much there is. We know that it interacts gravitationally with ordinary matter, but we have no idea what it is.
Does that mean that there is a mysterious particle out there that could reveal what dark matter is?
So there are many hypotheses for what the dark matter could be. I think most particle theorists believe, and I think also hope, that it might be some new elementary particle. You know, if we look at ordinary atomic matter, ordinary atoms are composed of nuclei, which are made out of protons and neutrons, and there are electrons that are in orbit around those nuclei. And the protons and neutrons are themselves made out of quarks. And it turns out that throughout the 20th century and into the beginning of the 21st century, we've developed a very successful model that accounts for all of the interactions of the elementary particles that we know. But that model we do know is incomplete. It's mathematically self-inconsistent. And so all of the theories that we have to try to fix the mathematical inconsistency involve the introduction of new elementary particles. So there's some hope and some reason to believe that the dark matter is composed of some new elementary particle that we have yet to discover, but we don't know what it is and we have not yet discovered it. So that is the prevailing hypothesis, but we're not actually sure that it's correct.
LIGO detectors picked up signals of two sets of gravitational waves, first in September of 2016 and the other around Christmas 2016. It's a thought that both gravitational waves were the result of two black holes in a binary system colliding, and their explosive merger then sent the gravitational waves throughout the universe. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah, so this one is pretty straightforward, thanks to Albert Einstein and one century of study by general relativists. There are lots of stars in the universe, billions. There are several billion just in the Milky Way. Our star is sort of unusual in that it's alone. Most stars in the Milky Way and in the universe, as far as we know, are in binaries. They're orbiting around each other. We have two of them that are in orbit around each other. And stars have a finite lifetime. They don't live forever. What keeps them bright is the nuclear fuel that they're burning in their cores, but there's only a finite amount of this. And when that runs out, a star can undergo several of possible fates. And very massive stars, we know, will undergo a supernova explosion and wind up producing a black hole. And so it's no surprise that there are not only black holes in the universe, but there are also binary black holes in the universe. And after some period of time, those binary black holes can spiral in closer and closer, emitting gravitational radiation. And at some point, they become very, very close, and they merge, and they emit a burst of gravitational waves, which carries away the energy that was originally in the binary. And LIGO, after many years of effort, finally saw one such binary black hole in September of 2015, and then another such gravitational wave signal from another binary black hole in late December.
How common do you think binary black holes are in the universe?
I know a lot more now than I did just a few months ago. So according to LIGO's measurements, there are roughly 10 per gigaparsec cubed per year. So gigaparsec is a unit of distance that we use in cosmology. It's a very large distance. It's 1,000 megaparsecs. And roughly speaking, a megaparsec is the difference, the typical separation between two galaxies. And so what this means is that there's roughly one such black hole merger per billion galaxies per year.
The findings from LIGO presented one thing regarding the sensing of the gravitational waves, but you folks working on your research came up with that the black hole binary detected by the LIGO may be a signature of dark matter. How does what LIGO found lead you to a possibility of dark matter?
My group and I are cosmologists, and we think about dark matter, and we try to figure out what it is. And LIGO announced the merger of these two black holes, and it was a spectacular triumph. It wasn't too much of a surprise that there are binary black holes in the universe, but we were a little surprised by the masses of these black holes. So the two black holes in the original event had masses of 36 solar masses and 29 solar masses. So one of them was 36 times as massive as the Sun, and the other one was 29 times as massive as the Sun. And these are fairly big numbers compared to, I think, what we would have expected for the black holes that arises in fate of stellar evolution. I think we would have guessed more like 10 solar masses. And as it turns out, there are no observational or experimental reasons to exclude 30 solar mass objects as the dark matter. As I said, we don't know what the dark matter is. The prevailing hypothesis is that it's some new elementary particle. But as it turns out, if someone were to come in and tell me or speculate that the dark matter in the universe consists of 30 solar mass primordial black holes, there's no measurement or observation that I could point to that rules out that possibility. So it is an empirical possibility. And what we then did is we actually figured out how often these black holes, if they did make up the dark matter, would run into each other in a typical galaxy like the Milky Way. And as it turns out, if we do hypothesize that the dark matter in the universe consists of 30 solar mass primordial black holes, then those black holes would, in fact, run into each other with the rate that's more or less comparable to the rate inferred by the LIGO event.
Professor Kami Yankowski, thank you so much for talking with us today and sharing some of the findings that you and your colleagues made.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for the great questions.
That was Mark Kamienkowski, theoretical physicist and a professor with the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. Our fourth and final guest today is Andrew Coates, professor of physics in the Department of Space and Climate Physics at the University College of London in the United Kingdom. Professor Coates is co-author of a study that suggests an electric wind on Venus strong enough to strip away the elements that makes up water from its upper atmosphere may have also played a substantial role in ridding the planet of its oceans. Professor Coates, you and your colleagues at the University College London and NASA have found an electric wind on Venus that may have been causing a calamity on our neighboring planet. Can you tell us what the wind is doing and what it may be responsible for on Venus?
Yeah, well, what seems to happen is this electric wind forms well above Venus's atmosphere, and actually has the effect of actually pulling out the atmosphere into space. And so this is something which we see at a number of different objects in the solar system. It happens at the Earth, it happens at Venus, it happens at Mars, it happens at Titan. But remarkably, these new measurements show that it's actually a very strong potential which develops at Venus, which is enough to actually pull the heavy oxygen as well as the light hydrogen from water straight out of the atmosphere. So it's something which might well have played a very important role in the evolution of the planet's atmosphere.
It's referred to as an electric wind. What is an electric wind?
Sunlight, which of course bathes all of our planets in light and ultraviolet and X-rays as well, this actually ionizes the top of the atmosphere. So it pulls apart things like the molecules of water, but also in our case, nitrogen and oxygen. And in Venus's case, it's a carbon dioxide-rich atmosphere. So all of those molecules which are at the top of the atmosphere there can get ionized. And so the idea is that the electrons move away from the ions. Now, the electrons find it easy to move along the magnetic field. So the solar wind has a magnetic field. Venus itself lacks a magnetic field, and that might play part of the fact that this is actually quite a large potential. But so these electrons move along the magnetic field. So that creates a charge separation. So you get the negative electrons moving away, the positive ions staying there. And so actually those electrons can set up an electric field or a potential which moves the positive ions out as well. So this sort of sucks out the ions from the ionosphere. And so this is the new measurement here, is to actually measure the size of that potential for the first time. And it turns out to be relatively large on Venus.
If the winds are blowing away these ions, either of oxygen or hydrogen, where are the ions going then?
Well, they escape to space. So the idea is that in the top of the atmosphere, of course, they're there, they're sort of pulled in towards the planet by gravity. But these forces, like the electric field, that's one of the non-gravitational forces which can operate on these. And that actually pulls away the particles into space. So they're lost from the planet forever. We calculate, actually, based on not this paper but an earlier one, where we actually measured the rate at which Venus is losing its atmosphere. And we find in that case it's about 100 tons of material from its atmosphere per year. So if you take that over billions of years, this process has been operating. That's an awful lot of material, and that means that these parts of the atmosphere have been lost to space for that. And it could create an explanation for why Venus is much drier than the Earth. So we don't have oceans or anything on Venus. It's a little bit closer to the sun, so there are other reasons as well. But this is another reason why Venus is somewhat different to the Earth and why it could have lost its oceans more quickly. And obviously we do have oceans, we do have water on Earth. It's a great place for life, whereas Venus is not. And so this is one of the interesting features about Venus, and one of the ways in which we can distinguish it and look for similarities and differences. In this case, there's a big difference between Venus and the Earth.
What tools and resources were available to you and your colleagues in order to make these findings?
Well, we used the Venus Express spacecraft, which is a European Space Agency spacecraft in orbit around Venus. And so we've been looking at the data from that in a number of different studies. This is the latest in a string of studies which we've been doing about Venus. One that we did last year, as I say, we measured the amount of material which is being lost by this mechanism. We made a few years ago the first observation of the photoelectrons, and so these are the electrons which have a fingerprint signature that they've been associated with this ionization process high up in the atmosphere. So we made the first observation of that at Venus. And so the instrument on the spacecraft, it's part of the Aspera 4 package. That is a large consortium of instruments, and the particular instrument that we used is the electron spectrometer on the Venus Express spacecraft.
Andrew, it's been said that among the planets of the solar system, several ways Venus is most like Earth. Now, could you give us some of the similarities between the two planets and maybe some of the differences?
Venus is closer to the sun than we are. It's at about 3/4 of the distance. But Venus is almost the same size, about 95% of the Earth's diameter, and it's made of very similar stuff from the beginning of the solar system. But that's really where the big similarities stop, because Venus itself, in some ways, it's Earth's evil twin. It has behaved very differently over the years. So because of it being close to the sun, it has a runaway greenhouse effect, which started with water but then ends up with carbon dioxide as well. Carbon dioxide is the main constituent of the very thick atmosphere. And that keeps the surface temperature extremely hot, so something like 470 degrees centigrade. It's hot enough to melt lead, so really the surface is extremely hot. The atmosphere is very thick. It lacks a magnetic field. That's another difference to the Earth. So the similarities really stop at the sort of fairly close proximity in the solar system, fairly similar in diameter, and similar in age. But apart from that, it's very different, and Venus is sort of hellish place, which I don't think there's any life at.
Professor Coates, thanks so much for taking time today to talk about your team's findings. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That was Andrew Coates, Professor of Physics in the Department of Space and Climate Physics at the University College of London in the United Kingdom. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this science edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank all of our guests for joining us for today's program. This is Rick Pantaleo, reminding you to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.